Well, perfect. Then let's start with the last lecture on social computing, social gaming. I know you're sad. It's not. Oh, yeah, of course. It's one of the best lecture in the universe. Okay, cool. Well, today we're going to finish our considerations on game theory, right? Well, that's what we're going to do. Okay. Remember what we said about solving these simple games, and that was in terms of the indifference condition, right? Remember, so what was the indifference condition? So the indifference condition meant that in a mixed Nash equilibrium, a player that assigns positive probability to a number of pure strategy alternatives must be indifferent in terms of the actual, which one will actually be played, because that must give the same utility to him, right? And this indifference is what we can use to solve games, right? And one example was this stupid, slightly sexist battle of the sexes with the choices of ballet and football. And if you remember how this went about, we said that, okay, in order to come up with the mixed Nash equilibrium, we can use the indifference condition by stating that, well, the first player, may that be man or woman, we don't care for the moment. The first player randomizes with X, so he will choose, he or she, it will choose football with a probability of X and ballet with a probability of 1 minus X. And the other one will randomize with Y. So he or she will choose ballet with a probability of Y and football with 1 minus Y. Now, the indifference between player 1 states that, considering the randomization of the second player, I must be indifferent between football or ballet, right? So this one is randomized with a Y. So 0 times Y plus 2 times 1 minus Y is the expected utility if F is played, right? On behalf of player one. And the expected utility if B is played by player one is 1 minus Y times 0 plus 0 times 1 minus Y, right? So this is the indifference of player one. So player one mustn't care whether he or she actually does F or B, because in any of the mixed situations that he mixes with X, we said that the utility, the expected utility with respect to the second player's randomization must be equal when I play F or B, right? So that's the indifference condition on behalf of player one, which yields the randomization of the second player. And the indifference of the second player yields the randomization of the first player. And that's all in the Nash equilibrium, where we simultaneously choose our randomizations, right? So that's not a multi-stage game. And as you can see, if you do that for the game of chicken, you'll find that this is the actual Nash equilibrium, right? So that was what we did last time. And then we said something about focal point and risk dominance. And, some more remarks before we do a more general consideration, okay? So risk dominance has another side to it, right? So remember that in game theory, we always think of rational behavior, strictly rational behavior. So we don't genuinely regard anything that has to do with real psychology, real emotions. It's all strict logic. But if we know that in real life, emotions do play a role, right? And this can even be formalized. Well, so for example, in this game, we see that there are two pure Nash equilibria. That's UL and DR, okay? We can accept that. We can check that these are actually pure Nash equilibria. However, we see that UL, Pareto dominates DR because 9-9 is larger than 7-7. Okay, so we should think that in the question, with regard to the question of what we should do, we would think that both players should agree on playing UL, because that's the rational choice. However, we see that for player one, playing up is somewhat risky, because the minimum guaranteed payoff, if actually playing up, is zero. Whereas if I, as a first player, play down, I would get a minimum guaranteed payoff of 7, right? So in other words, thinking of this minimum guaranteed payoff, if I assess the probability, and that's more of a, well, yeah, not a mixing probability, but rather something psychological for the moment, right? If I regard that the probability of the other player of playing R is larger than 1/8, I would certainly not go for the Nash equilibrium UL, because then I can get a less pronounced payoff, right? And the question is, can that be solved by letting the players do some talking before playing the game, right? And the talking could be something like, well, come on, it's in the best interest of both of us. We'll get 9-9 instead of 7-7. It's only rational. Both are Nash equilibria, blah, 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 blah. But in the end, this is like an empty thing, because player two will always tell that he or she is going to play L, right? Because that's in his natural interest. So he will always tell L regardless of his true intentions. So the agreement is practically worthless. So, and in our human endeavors, what we use in order to make these conversations non-trivially worthful is we use social signal processing. So we gain more information about the probability that someone is truthful, right? But speaking from a strict rationalist point of view, well, he or she could be a good liar. And if he or she manages to control his or her behavioral cues, then it's logically worthless, such a conversation, right? So it's all is in the social signal processing and in the evaluation of additional context factors, right? So what do I know about the history of that person? Is the context such that I can expect a more beneficial behavior? But pinpointing it down to the game itself, it is actually worthless, okay? Then in terms of, well, Pareto optimal Nash equilibria and risk, there's the concept of coalitions, okay? Let's assume we're having a three-player game, and the third player only has options A or B. So this gives such a, yeah, cuboid style of matrix, so a three-dimensional thing, which we can also denote slice-wise, right? So here are the two slices of this three-dimensional thing, and this is the situation if player three plays A, and that's the situation if player three actually plays B, okay? Well, analyzing this with the usual measures will give us the insight that we have two pure Nash equilibria, that's UL and A, and DRB is also a pure Nash equilibrium. Once again, if we compare ULA with DRB, we see that the gain for all three parties is higher in ULA compared to DRB, right? So we have the same situation as before. So normally, if the players are strictly rational, they should choose the ULA equilibrium. However, if we regard the situation when player 3's choice is fixed, what we find on behalf of player 1 and 2 is a simple 2x2 game, right? Ignoring that the other one has also a choice of freedom. And in that two-player game, we see that DR is Pareto dominant compared to UL. Okay, because here we have a gain of 0-0, here we have a gain of 1-1. And DR is actually part of the Nash equilibrium DRB, right? So for the first players, if they happen to, if they expect the third player to play A, they might coordinate on DR, right? And those subtle considerations lead to subtle notions. For example, the subtle notion of coalition-proof equilibrium, right? Because we will see that ULA is not coalition-proof in that sense, while DRB is, right? So there is no coalition that can be formed that would alter the respective situation, right? If you're interested in these things, I would refer you to the book by Fudenberg and Tyrol, so you know that the relevant parts for the lecture and for the exam are uploaded onto Piazza as a PDF scan from the book, right? If you haven't already seen that. Now, let's investigate the situation for mixed and pure Nash equilibria for 2x2 games in a more general form, right? So what's the case if we have a very, very, very general game matrix, right? So player A has a mixing of P and 1 minus P, the other one of Q, 1 minus Q, up, down, left, right. And these are the respective gains or utilities that are to be won in the game. Okay. Now, in a pure Nash equilibrium, we know we basically select one cell. Okay. So, seen from the perspective of player A, the respective cell's payoff from the point of view of player A must be, the weak maximum over the rows in that particular column. Okay. And for player B, the cell's payoff must be the weak maximum over the column in that row. Okay. So, for example, UR is a pure Nash equilibrium. This one here, right? If UR is at least as big as DR, right? And BUR, this one, is at least as big as BUL. Okay, so that's what I have to check for a pure Nash equilibrium, and that's nothing basically than this technique of iterated strict dominance, right? So strict dominance would yield a larger than, but here the same is true, okay? So we must distinguish between the pure Nash equilibrium and its more strict counterparts, right? But what's the situation here in a mixed situation? Okay, good. What we have to do is we would just have to compute what's going on, okay? And we will do so in terms of response functions. And this indifference condition is basically nothing different, right? So in a Nash equilibrium, we know that my randomization is the best response to the other player's randomization, and the other player's randomization is the best response to my randomization, right? We'll get more examples later on. So having this matrix, let's start, right? So we start with player A's point of view. We know player B plays some mixed strategy, and the mixing parameter is Q, right? Because the other one is then 1 minus Q. So we'll denote the best response of player A by P, and the star indicates the Nash equilibrium, P as a function of Q, and 1 minus P as a function of Q. Or in short, since this one is a bit redundant, P star of Q, right? So that's the best response. So the utility, the expected utility on behalf of player A, considering his randomization and the other player's randomization, is this one here, right? So PQ, this is the randomization for this cell, times AUL, and AUR has this randomization factor, and so on, right? And if you reorder the terms, you'll get this general formula for the utility of player A, which has this, well, delta term here in the square brackets, right, which is a function of the randomization of player B, right, so a function of Q, and then a term linear in Q, and all these factors have to do with the gain factors, the utility factors A of player A. Good. And the question what to do now breaks down to a case differentiation with respect to the sign of this expression delta of Q here, right? So obviously, if delta of Q is positive, then I will play P star as equal to 1, because that's the best I can do, right? So that's the only place where I can influence my gain, okay? And I will put all in there. If I have to gain a little bit of this delta, I will go all in for that, right? And I play P star equal to 0 if this delta is a negative term, because I want to maximize my utility, right? And if that delta of Q is 0, I can practically play any P, because anything multiplied with 0 will be 0, right? So that is all there is left if delta is 0. So I have these three cases, basically, right? Now let's repeat that again. So in this thing here, it's just the utility of player A, right? So that's certainly what we have, right? Let's further do the case differentiation, right? So let's be more fine-grained. If this delta expression is identically 0 for all the Qs, right? So we see that this delta is a linear function of the Qs. And if this first factor here is identically 0, and this one is also 0, then we see that delta, no matter what Q is always 0. So for all Qs, A can play whatever he or she likes, right? Because multiplying something with 0 would always yield 0. So A is completely indifferent with respect to what is happening. Now, if delta is not identically 0, what we see is, again, delta is an affine linear function here, right? So more or less a straight line, yeah? So delta Q is affine linear, and it has at most one zero, right? And the only chance that it can have less than one zero if it's parallel to the x-axis, right? So we have Q and delta of Q, right? So that's the only chance where it doesn't have a zero. That's why it says at most. And almost all the straight lines will have a zero at one or the other point. So if we said the for the case that the derivative is identically zero, as in this case here, right? So here, the derivative, the inclination is zero, right? And then we can say the zero of that one is somewhere at plus infinity, right? This is consistent, right? Because we can say two parallel lines somewhere intersect at infinity. That's okay. So we can say it has exactly one zero, okay? Now we can investigate where this zero actually is. So if the zero is in 0 or 1 in this interval here, right, then we have some parts where obviously this delta is less than zero, and some other parts where the delta is larger than zero, right? And one spot where it is actually zero. So, player number A will then play P equal to 1 for the positive cases and P equal to 0 for the case where this delta is negative. So these are the cases where A has a dominant pure strategy, right? Because that randomization is then exactly not existent. And if that zero is, so that was the case where the zero, sorry, the third case is the zero, where the zero is here in between zero and one. If the zero is somewhere else outside zero or one, right, then in that range zero or one, the function would always be negative, right? So then it's clear whether it's totally negative or totally positive depends what I'm going to do. I'm going to play In any case, I'm going to play P equal to 1 or P equal to 2, right? So these are basically the same cases. It just depends whether the 0 is inside 0, 1 or not, right? So that's a more a depiction here of this, right? So that's our 0 point Q plus. And to the here, to the right, to the left of it, where this function is negative, I would always play P equal to 0, and in these cases where it's positive, P equal to 1, okay? And on the exact 0, I can play whatever I like, right? Because that 0 multiplied with something will always yield 0, right? Now, the same analysis, which is completely symmetric, can also be done for B, right? So what I then have is a reaction function P star of Q. That's in an analogous situation to the Cournot equilibrium that we discussed and will discuss again today. So that's for the first player, and the other one will have a reaction function Q star of P, right? Q star of P. And again, so, and these will look similar, of course, right? And what will happen is for the first player, it will look like this. And we know that we just have to compute the intersection of the reaction functions. Yeah, okay, good. No Nazi symbols here. But however, you'll just have to do the intersection and you'll find the Nash equilibrium, okay? And that's more or less a general thing here, okay? So going back to this thing with the Cournot equilibrium, right? We said that, okay, the whole stuff that we discuss is static games, and static games of complete information, meaning that all the players know everything, right? And we only have a one-shot game. They can simultaneously choose what they want to do, and then the game is over. Bam. Normally, and that's what we've seen when discussing this Axelrod tournament and the iterated prisoner's dilemma, things can change if we play a game multiple times or if the game has multiple stages, in other words, right? So what we're now very briefly will discuss is dynamic games, again, of complete information. So I know everyone knows everything about the possibilities and the gains and so on. But now we have multiple moves. Okay. Good. So that's what it is. In part one, we had the players make choices simultaneously. Now the order, there's an order of choices, and this order of choices makes the knowledge about the other player's actions actually explicit, right? So remember the Cournot equilibrium. Let's repeat that what we had there, right? So let's go back to the Cournot equilibrium. That was that, right? So we saw that we have a utility function of two companies, and one company can choose its output Q1 and the other company can choose its output Q2. And there is a price for the good in question, the single good that's produced, and that's dependent on the whole production of both companies, right? So that's the thing where we say we can encode something like a demand function. If there are more goods, the price will go down. So what is usual is to assume linear demand, for example, right? And we know that since the price for the good is determined by the total production, the company can gain for each thing that it produces the price. So Q times P is the benefit that the company has minus the cost for producing QI many of these goods, right? And each company can, of course, have a different cost structure. That's where you can act if you're an economist. So that's the most general term for the respective company's profit. So both have the same type of function. However, the cost function can differ, and the QIs are the degree of freedom in that game, right? So the game choices. And then we said what we want is to compute a Cournot or a general reaction function again, such as in the general example that we made here, right? So what's each company's optimum reaction to what the other company does? Okay, and that's what we can compute. And it's clear that the Nash equilibrium is where both functions will intersect, because then we know each company's production amount Q is the optimal reaction to the other company's production amount, right? And that's where the curves intersect. And how did we do that? So we want, as let's say company number two, the degree of freedom that we have is choosing Q2, right? That's the only thing we can do. The other company will choose Q1, right? And we have a gain U2, and that needs to be maximized. And so I improved this here on the slides, because in the previous version there were total D's. Now I replaced them with partial D's, because that's more accurate in this case, right? So I will have to, given that Q1 is set, I don't know what the other company will do for the moment. Let's assume it's just a scalar value that I have no influence on in the first place, right? I will optimize this with respect to Q2. And computing the derivative of this exact function here will yield this equation here. That is an equation that has to be fulfilled. Now, what we can insert now is our Q2, our choice as company 2, is dictated by the reaction function R2, and that's a function of Q1. What the other company does. So my output is the optimal reaction to the other company's output. So everywhere in this equation where Q2 is, I will insert R2 of Q1. Okay? And that gives this defining equation. So that's a functional equation for the Cournot reaction function R2. And symmetric considerations will yield R1, right? So in this case, very simple, right? And that's how we can actually do that. Now, you might ask, that is something that I may have explained in a bit confused way in the last session. Q1, again, right, is also dependent on Q2. Why it's they're vice versa dependent, right? So what would happen if right from the start we wouldn't compute something like D to the D Q2 of U2, but instead would compute something like D to the D Q2 of U2, right? Assuming that right from the start Q1 is a function of Q2, right? So you could think like this, but in effect, this would mean that this equation here would only depend on Q2 again, so the whole reasoning cannot be led through, right? And even more so, of course, Q2 is again a function of Q1, right? So we would have to be even more complicated in that fashion, yeah? And you see where this heads, right? So with this type of reasoning, you just won't get far, right? And that's the reason why for the moment you set Q1 as a constant, right? And then compute the optimal reaction. And then the whole reasoning is consistent if you finish it, right? So you don't need to dig into these depths. Personally, I don't know if there's any solution in that regard, if that's completely illogical. It'll certainly lead to systems of differential equations. I don't know what their solution is. But we will see that in a multi-stage game, these things will have a special interpretation now. Okay? And that's where we head to, right? And this is that. Okay? Now, let's assume we play the game in a different fashion. Okay? Let's assume we have two stages. So the first company first chooses Q1. The second company notices that, and then in the second stage chooses its output Q2. Does that change something? Okay. Well, what's the reasoning? The reasoning is as follows, right? Good. Let's assume for the moment that our production is costless, right? So that means we can produce as many goods as we like. The only consideration here is if we produce very many goods, the price will go down, right? And so this is the utility for costless production and linear demand, right? For each company I, okay? Now, obviously, if the first company plays something, the second company will somehow react. So the utility gain is, again, determined by inserting this optimal reaction to the first company's choice Q1. Okay, good. Now, if we have given our Q1, what we need to do is we would just need to maximize Q2 with respect to that given Q1. Now, again, Q2 is the only choice we have as a company too, and we will have to deal with Q1 as a given thing, right? So the first company just does it. So we have already seen what this heads to, and that's exactly the Cournot reaction function, okay? And how is that computed? Well, we can do that for the moment to see once again where this heads to, right? This is exactly the same as in the Cournot case, right? So we know what we need to do is du2 to the dq2, right? Because that's the thing we can influence, and these are partial derivative signs using Q1 as a constant, right? So that's d to the dq2 of 12 minus Q1 minus Q2 times Q2, right? And if you compute this, and this is naturally needs to be maximized, right? So this must be equal to zero. And for the moment, we'll not regard the second derivative, assuming that it's actually a maximum, right? You can check, this is then the maximum. And if I pull this through, what I get is, well, the intermediate steps can be neglected, right? If you want, I can do them, but it's very simple algebra. What you get is that we get the equation 12 minus Q1 minus 2 Q2, and that is expected to be zero. And now what we do is we say Q2 should be the optimal reaction R2 as a function of Q1. Right? So this then, if we just insert for Q2, R2 of Q1, what we get is that R2 of Q1 as written on the slides is 6 minus Q 1 half. Okay? Good. And that's basically how this is. And the same will then go for the other one, right? Now, the other company knows that, knows all the considerations, and says, well, what am I going to do now? And here is the interesting part, because U1, the utility for the first company, is naturally dependent on Q1, but now we insert for Q2 already the reaction R2 of Q1. Right? Now we do it, because in this case, we know that R2 of Q1 is what the second company must play, right? That's this one. And we can maximize this, insert this, compute the derivative, right? So what we would then do is just compute du1 of Q1 and inserting this R2 of Q1, right? And it doesn't matter here if we write the partial or the full, right? And that's the same in this case, d to the dq1, and this must be zero, right? And if you do that for all the, for this given utility function, what you get is that q1 star, right? So the optimal choice for the first company in the Nash equilibrium is actually 6, right? And if we insert this here, Q2 star will then be 4, right? So 6, 4 is the equilibrium that we had to. And if you compute this for, so this is like a new form of equilibrium, and that's called the Stackelberg equilibrium. Before it was the Cournot equilibrium, now this is the Stackelberg equilibrium, and this will yield to a payoff of 18 and 9, right? So these are, this is U1 and U2. These are the values in the respective equilibrium, right? Now, for the Cournot equilibrium for this function, what would that be? Of course, for the Cournot case, R1 of Q2 is symmetric, because the considerations are symmetric, so that's 6 minus Q2 over half, right? So the Cournot equilibrium would be to play 4, 4 instead of 6, 4, right? And this would yield an output, a utility of 16, 16. Yeah? Well, it's different, right? Just by drawing apart the choices. So in the simple one-stage Cournot game, where they simultaneously have to choose, the Nash equilibrium is 4, 4, yielding 16, 16. And in the choice where the first company has the first move, it'll increase the utility by 2, and it'll decrease the utility by 7 for the second company, surprisingly so, right? Just by saying that the order of choices does actually matter. And the interesting point is here, because here we insert the reaction right from the start into our equation, right? Because we know that the other one will actually react in that fashion. And that's this nature of multi-stage games changing the nature of the Nash equilibrium. Okay? That is something we have seen in the prisoner's dilemma case as well, right? Now, carefully analyzing this situation is that there's a second equilibrium, even in the multi-stage game, and that's the Cournot equilibrium, the usual one, right? Why is this a Nash equilibrium? Well, you can read it. If player two chooses the Cournot quantity Q2 Cournot, right? So that's 4. Independent of what the first player does, what the first player must play is its optimal Cournot reaction, and that is, again, this one here. So if the other one plays that, the first player can do no better than to play 4 in the first place, and the other way round. Okay? Good. So, and if the first player plays the Cournot, actually the second player can use any reaction function as long as it yields to this value here, basically, right? Okay, and one possibility would be to choose that constant reaction, right? Now, this is a Nash equilibrium, but there's something foul about this, because the Stackelberg equilibrium seems to be a bit more convincing. And why is that more convincing? Well, this statement, player 2 plays Q Cournot 2, independent of what the first player does, is somehow an empty threat, right? Because the first company has the first choice. And it can make the first choice. So if the first player deviates from the Nash equilibrium, the second company, player 2, would always be better off with its optimal reaction. And we computed the optimal reaction, right? So that's that one, right? And that's that one we inserted here, right? To come up with the Stackelberg case, okay? So in a sense, if we undergo a process that is called backward induction, the Stackelberg equilibrium is somehow nicer because it's compatible with this backward induction process, while the Cournot equilibrium is not. And the choices that we documented are exactly the ones of backward induction, right? So what I first do is I analyze what the last player must do, given what the players before him or her did, right? And this is basically what we had here, yielding this simple reaction function, which is equal to the Cournot in this case, right? So that is what the last player will have to do, because the last player finds a given situation, right? And then I can backwardly induce what the next to last player will do, okay? And so on and so on. So here it's simple because we're only having 2 stages. But there can be more stages than that. So we roll the thing up by its tail, so to speak, right? So we reason what the last player will do and then induce what the other players will do in turn, okay? And now this is only a special case of a multi-stage game, because here we speak of a multi-stage game with alternating choices, basically. First, the first company chooses, then the second company chooses. We will now see that there is a more general form of multi-stage games where we will get to a new notion of Nash equilibrium, and that's this subgame perfect equilibrium, which we will now introduce, right? So let's be a bit more general. So in a multi-stage game, what do we have? So obviously we have multiple stages, and in each stage, a single game is played, right? So in the most general case, at each stage, all players make some decisions simultaneously, right? And that's what a usual multi-stage game is. And the stages will be counted from 0 to large K. And complete information means that all players know the actions from all other players in the previous stages. So we have observed what has happened in the past, okay? So, at each stage, small k, there is some action that each player can choose, right? So if there is I players, the action profile of some stage small k is this A with a superscript k, and that consists of I many actions that they take simultaneously, right? At the end of stage k, or respectively at the beginning of stage k plus 1, we have a certain history, right? So what has happened in the previous stages? Obviously, in the zeroth stage, there were some actions that were chosen. In the first stage, some actions were chosen by all players. Second stage, some actions up to the kth, small kth stage, where, again, some actions were chosen. And we can assume that the history at stage zero is just empty, right? Nothing has yet happened. And furthermore so, if we assume that the set of actions that each player can take at a stage is dependent on that stage, which is only natural, I'll explain that in a second, then we can denote this as large AI of HK, right? Why is that useful, right? So assume a duel between two Western guys, right? So each one has an action at its hand. Aim high, aim low, aim at the man, right? And well, it depends on the history, what the other player did, whether I still have any action options, right? So if the other player chose to aim at my head and pulled the trigger, then I simply don't have any action moves left, right? So it's only fair to assume that the set of action that a player can take is dependent on this history, right? Now, our previous thing with the Stackelberg equilibrium was one example of this, where we deliberately set in the first stage the action set of the second company as the zero set, the empty set, and the action set of the first company in the second stage also to the empty set. Right? This then yields a strictly alternating move game. Right? So a game with alternating moves is just a special case of this general multi-stage game, just by setting the action alternatives accordingly. Yeah? Good. Now, how does our notion of pure strategy generalizes in this case, right? So obviously, if I'm having a finite number of stages, large K, my pure strategy as player I is some plan, SI, where I determine what action I'm going to take at each stage. So basically, these SK of I map the history up to the present moment to some action in the action set that is determined by that history, right? So at each point in time, for each stage, I must define a mapping. If some history happens, what am I going to do at this stage, right? So a strategy is something much more complicated here, because it's not only a sequence of actions, but it's more a sequence of mappings, because as in the example with the Western guys, I must say, if at the seventh stage I'm hit in the head, my plan is to do nothing because I can't do anything, right? And let's assume if at the seventh stage I'm hit in the leg, I might do something different than if I'm hit in the arm, right? So this is why it's a mapping of the set of possible actions to some optimal action, okay? And this is a pure strategy plan. We can also have a mixed strategy plan by just defining a probability distribution over this set of available actions at any stage, at any point in time. This is just the same as for mixed profiles that we had, right? And obviously, if we drop the index for the players, we would have vectors of mappings. So this action profile at stage K is the result of all player strategy given the history, right? So a mapping of this given history to another, number of actions being taken. And this history is also called a path, right? Obviously, for each player, the payoff is dependent on the history, right? So if I'm hit in the arm, in the leg, and in the other leg, my utility is different than if I'm only hit in the left arm, right? In this stupid game, right? So whatever the history is, after large K many steps or stages have been played, that's what I gain, right? And a pure strategy Nash equilibrium is then defined as a strategy profile in that sense that is optimal for all players, considering that it's the best option while comparing for any alternative S prime such plan, right? So in the Nash equilibrium, my utility, and that's for all the players, the utilities must be larger or equal than their alternatives. Okay, that's more or less the same definition, but with a different interpretation what the actual actions are. Yeah? Because here we're talking about plans, more or less, and the plans are mappings. Good. What we've seen is in the Stackelberg case, where things are a bit more easy because we're having these alternating moves, we can easily do something that we call backward induction, right? So we can see what the last player will do given the history of what has happened so far, right? And then we can induce back what the next to last player is likely to do or will do if he or she is a rationalist, right? Good. And what we say is that a multi-stage game is a game of perfect information if at each stage only one player has a non-trivial action set. So these alternating moves games are games of perfect information. Why is that? Because at each stage, I'm the one in turn, right? So at stage number 5, it's my turn. If I'm player number 5, let's say, right? And I know exactly what the other players 1, 2, 3, 4 did before in the 4 stages before my move, right? That's why I have perfect information. And that's different from complete information, because complete information just means I know their utilities and I know all the conditions of the game. But if at each stage more than one player draws, makes simultaneous choices, I don't have perfect information, because at the given stage, I don't know what the others might do. If I'm the only one in turn to do something, then I know the complete past and I have perfect information, right? So it's a difference between complete information as a notion and perfect information. Right? Good. Okay. One observation, obviously, is that if we play very many times and drop our requirement of strict rationality, if we activate psychology again, this rationalist type of thinking kind of tends to wear off. Right? So the logics of backward induction are weakened by an increasing number of stages K. Because if we play 1,000 times, then the logic becomes very complicated and it's, well, humans at least wouldn't be able to adhere to the strict logic, right? That's what it's meant by the observation that the rationality kind of becomes weaker and fades away. Okay. Now, let's give another example for this notion of subgame perfection before we formally define it, right? Now, again, 2 companies, 2 firms, and 2 stages, right? Let's assume that at the first stage, player 2 or company 2's action possibilities are just void. So the empty set. So company 2 cannot do anything at stage number 1. At stage number 1, only firm number 1 has a non-trivial action set. And the action is very simple. So it can invest into a new technology that would lower its production costs, or it can choose not to invest, right? In the first stage. In the second stage, again, both companies choose their output, Q1 and Q2. And naturally, this kind of depends on what the first company did in the first stage, because that influences the cost structure of the first company, right? So in second stage, it's a simple game like that, right? And that's what we have. So that's not a game of perfect information. Why? Because it's not strictly alternating. Because in the second stage, both choose. Both can do something or have to do something. Good. Now, however, the thing is that each history with respect to stage number 1 generates a normal strategic form game. So that's a game like this one, a one-stage game, basically, that we had, right? And what we can do is we can compute the Nash equilibrium of that second stage, and that's what then yields a subgame perfect Nash equilibrium, right? How can we generalize that? Okay. Now, obviously, the history before stage number K, and remember that was the definition, right? So, the history at the end of stage K, so the beginning of stage K plus 1, is denoted by H K plus 1. So before stage K plus 1 actually takes place, the history is already H K plus 1, right? So at before stage K, the history is H K, right? Now, from the stage K on until the last stage, large K, we might call this again a multi-stage game. But now, obviously, the game is dependent on the history. Exactly as in this simple example. Yeah? It depends on what happened in the past, and the future can also be multi-stage, right? And this multi-stage game from stage K on, we will denote as G of HK, right? The payoff for the players is, again, dependent on the whole history, right? So the total payoff is the payoff after the last stage, so at history large K plus 1, and that's where all the stages are already played, right? However, we know that the strategies in this game G of HK must, again, be maps from histories to actions, but we are somehow constrained, right? Because we said we started this game after a history HK. So we're free for the future, but bound for the past, right? So I can only choose histories that are consistent with the past. What I've done in the past cannot be changed, but I can only change things in the future. So the strategies are maps from histories to actions that must be consistent with the past. Okay, that's what you have in your life as well, right? Where do I go out? In which bar do I go out, right? So the choice is free, but only as far as what you've done yesterday. If you shot yourself, the choices are different than if you just didn't shoot yourself, right? So this is kind of clear, I'd say, right? Good. So the strategy profile of the whole game induces a strategy profile that's kind of limited on the history HK on this game that is now played for the future considering a given past, right? So for all players, this one here is a restriction of the possible free choice from the beginning to something that's consistent with the past, right? And now the definition of subgame perfect equilibrium, right? So a strategy profile S of the whole multi-stage game, yeah, with observed actions is in subgame perfect equilibrium if for all histories that are, yeah, kind of considerable, the restriction S under the condition HK to HK on this game from now on is a Nash equilibrium of this game from now on, right? So for each stage, right, we have a game of the future, that's G of HK, right, for each stage K. And what we will do is we say that at each stage we must be in a Nash equilibrium for the multi-stage future game, right? That's what we understand by a sub-game perfect equilibrium. So each sub-game has already a Nash equilibrium, and that's consistent with the whole thing. That's what there is, right? And for games of perfect information, that is alternating moves games, right, where each player chooses in turn, this definition is the same as the definition of backward induction, right? So the Stackelberg equilibrium is subgame perfect in that sense, right? Because once the first player has chosen Q1, the game in the second stage is itself a Nash equilibrium, right? Because that's a very artificial, very simple example. Maybe this one here is a bit more instructive, because in the second stage something non-trivial happens, if you want. But well, as it's written here, if we have alternating moves games, this subgame perfect equilibrium definition is the same as this backward induction style of analysis, right? Good. Now let's count this through in another example, okay? Let's take this one here, as before, the thing with the investment choice, right? Now, first, we have the two firms, the two stages. We have a unit cost of 2 per unit, so that's a constant cost, no matter what, right? And what this investment of company one does is it reduces the cost per unit production to 0, right? So before, if company one does not invest, we still have a cost of 2 per unit produced, right? And if the company does invest, the cost per unit produced is reduced to 0. The only thing that I have is the investment cost F, right? So let's assume we buy a super duper fancy machine that can produce stuff for almost nothing, but the machine costs something, and that something for the machine is F. And so this is the cost function if investing, and that's the cost function if not investing. And company two doesn't have the privilege to have the choice of investing or not. Company two must just do what it does. Okay. So again, we have these cost functions, and we already see that they are very similar to what we had in this Stackelberg analysis. Okay. So if company one does not invest, what we're left with is a simple Cournot-style one-stage game in the second stage, right? So the reactions are exactly those two reaction functions, right? And this is exactly what we have here. And the Cournot equilibrium resulting is 4-4, and the payoff is 16-16, right? And if the company one does invest, the reaction function of the first company slightly changes to R1 tilde, which is now 7 minus Q2 half, and the Nash equilibrium also slightly changes, right? And the payoff, if you compute that through, is this rather strange looking thing, which is dependent on the investment cost. So the rational choice is to invest if the gain in profit exceeds the gain compared to the simple Cournot case where no investment just takes place. So if 256 over 9 minus F is larger than 16, right? And company one's choice in terms of investing has two consequences. So the first consequence is it lowers its costs for producing something. That's rather obvious. And the second indirect choice is due to that lower production cost, it can be more aggressive on the market, right? Because that's the China effect, right? Because if I can produce for less money, I can be more aggressive on the market, put more goods in, and I'll get more profit, right? And this is basically what we have, right? So summing it up for one more minute, this thing with the subgame perfect equilibrium. So how should you approach that? So what you saw is that there are less examples in that second part, right? Or actually third part of the whole game stuff, right? And what I want is just to understand the concept or the consequences and the formalism of that multi-stage game type of thinking. And what's basically the most important point is maybe the difference between Cournot and Stackelberg, right? And if you think of the exam, I might ask you something that points to the level or kind of probes the level of understanding that is reached by working through these examples and trying to revolve that in your brain. Not that I would say, well, we have now a super shiny duper new multi-stage game with 15 stages and a complicated action set and please compute the subgame perfect Nash equilibrium, because that's a bit hard, right? What I would like you to do with this is to try to understand that and get a feeling for these things on the level of what has been presented here. That's basically the same for all of the lecture. So looking back at the whole lecture, right? You know from the fact sheet of the exam that I'm going to do a question hour about the whole lecture, and that's a few days before the exam. Why a few days before the exam? Answer, because nobody will have prepared anything if I do that earlier, right? And that's only natural. People, it's not true, not for you, but for 99.9 of the other students. So I made that, I had the question hour done, like, if it were now, I think I had it done on the, let's say, 20th of July, and that's way before any preparations are even considered, right? So I will push this as close to the exam as possible, and we will meet here in the lecture hall and discuss any questions that you might have from the lecture, right? And once again, if you don't know how to prepare for the exam, please read the fact sheet. And please study the questions on the slides, right? Because that will really help you with these considerations, right? And I think nobody should be left in the uncertain state of, oh my God, how could I prepare? What should I prepare? What are the questions like? These are all things that should be pretty clear, right? And there are these three stages, minimal, normal, and advanced students. So choose whatever you are, whatever you like to be, yeah, for this thing. If you really want to just pass, go for the minimal set. If you want to have a suitable mark, go for the middle section. And if you say, I want a 1.0, which is nice. And by the way, you can easily get that from the exam because I don't know what the board, there are 250 points. And I think that last year, I think, the boundary for 1.0 was around 170 or something. It's not that you would require 249 for a 1.0, please, no. And which is no cause to learn fewer things, right? Because then the reasoning just won't hold, right? So I will not go down as far as possible. Right? If the maximum number of points that is reached is 100, this person won't get a 1.0, right? Not. Because that's simply too few points. But if the maximum number is, let's say, 170, well, let's see how many get 150, and then I can fine-tune and say, okay, right? So just for the ones that are afraid of the exam and the large number of points and oh my God, right? So it should all be decent, okay? And since a lot of you have done the exercise and will gain some hopefully improving marks there, it's not that bad, right? So one more thing that I would like you to know is that another PhD student actually has an opportunity coming up for earning money, because what we do is we want to conduct an evaluation on availability management, right? So when is it appropriate for a telephone to ring, right? So that is something I refer to as an example quite a few times. And the experiment is scheduled for 2 weeks, I think, roughly in August, right? And the good thing is, if you install our app on your phone and really do the experiment, you can earn 300 euros, each one, not all of you, right? So we're calculating with around 70 participants, and we have raised some money for this because we know that people just won't do it for free. It's all business, right? And the only thing that you have to do basically is we send you SMS, and you get your natural SMS as well. And the only thing that is done is your social situation is recorded audio-wise while this SMS is being received. And the only thing you have to do once you receive an SMS is to fill out a super two-question questionnaire, right? So what, basically addressing what the situation was actually like that you were in. Were you in a church? Were you in a movie? Were you arguing with your friend? What were you doing? Were you playing football? I don't know, right? And this is just to be noted, and everything else is automatically done, right? So you install stuff on your Android phone, and you'll have to do this thoroughly. That's why you get the money. And I'll keep you informed and keep you posted with an announcement on the exact conditions. I think it's an attractive way to earn some money just by leading your normal life and letting us participate in that. So we, as always, we're very nosy and we want to know what you're up to. Of course, privacy is preserved. We're just computing features, right? We're not sending the audio. We're just sending audio features which guarantee that we cannot reconstruct what has actually been said on your phone, because I'm not Apple. I'm not the NSA. I don't want to know, right? The only thing I want to know is, can we compute some aspects of your social situation judging from the audio alone, right? That's all we want to know from this experiment. So look out for this. It's a good opportunity to earn money. And tell your friends, right? What we need is about 70 persons with Android phones, right? And if you don't have one, borrow one. No, that's not true, because we need to have your natural environment, right? Good. So for all of you, we'll see at the exam or the question hour, and good luck for preparing. And for the game students, good luck for the rest sprint in the lab course. Rock on, you can do it, right? So see you then next week for the game students, right? Ja, gut. Ja.